This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Mopeds. Have you always felt like you were the main character but something was missing? Try a moped today.
Welcome to episode 129 of The Sweaty Penguin, Antarctica's hottest podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Brown. I know that the schedule has been very wonky lately, and there's a number of reasons why. A lot of exciting new things in development. As you know, we've been in a weird funding situation, but I think there's some really exciting things on the horizon. Not gonna spoil anything until it's actually in writing, but in the meantime, we are gonna be focused on some big projects relating to that, so we're going to go back to our one episode per week schedule, deep dives and tip of the icebergs alternating each week. So hopefully that's okay with everybody. Hopefully it gives you time to catch up on any content you've missed and we can get back to a little consistency over here. I appreciate everyone listening despite that. Today we are talking about rice, the only grain that hasn't been deep fried at a county fair. For now. Rice is a crop grown on every continent except Antarctica, and it can last 10 to 30 years depending on how it's stored. It's valued all over the world as a staple food, is accessible, and typically easy to digest. It not only lasts long and is grown everywhere, rice is also in places you may not even think of. Like the Great Wall of China. Around 500 CE, sticky rice soup was combined with limestone to make an inorganic organic composite mortar that was extremely water resistant and strong. The same mortar is used in tombs, pagodas, and other city walls. That's right, rice walked so that your ramen noodle toilet repair TikTok could run. Never forget that. Rice is one of the foods so vital to both food security and built infrastructure. Truly the girl boss queen of grains. But just like any powerful girl boss, rice farming is far from perfect and comes with its own set of challenges. As a fellow powerful girl boss, I would know. In fact, over fear of a shortage and disruption to rice farming, coupled with rising food prices and inflation, India has actually banned the export of this valuable crop. The country is the world's largest exporter of rice. So this poses many questions and concerns regarding how the world moves forward to keep up with demand. In the US, people are even currently panic buying rice.
Triggering panic buying across the US, people stocking up, clearing shelves and waiting in long lines as many stores from coast to coast limit sales and hike prices, in some cases, more than twice as high.
This was just 2 months ago on MSNBC, and it's really unsettling. Far less stressful than the toilet paper rush, but still. Seriously, half our team has IBS. You guys need to cut that out. But rice is in the news right now, which should give you a sense of how valuable the crop is to many people. Because of a policy on the other side of the planet, Americans are flooding the grocery stores to stock up. And given just how important rice is to everyone, we're going to break it down today. We'll examine how rice impacts climate change, how climate change impacts rice, and how the industry can improve. If you want to take 2 minutes to help out the Sweaty Penguin, we would really appreciate it right now. Definitely need the help. You can either leave us a 5-star rating and review, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. Doing either earns you a special shout-out at the end of the show. Joining the Patreon gets you merch, bonus content, and a whole lot more, and will really help get us through this challenging funding situation until we can dot all the I's and cross all the T's with the opportunities that have come up, so please do subscribe. We really, really appreciate it. But first, it's time for Rice 101. Rice is an edible, starchy cereal grain, which essentially just means its plant is a grass specifically cultivated for the grain beneath the grass to be harvested. This results in an inferiority complex for the grass, so many farmers have taken to whispering affirmations to their rice plants to ensure only the finest harvest. Who's the grain with the mightiest sprout? That's you, little buddy. Feel my whisper tickle your husk. Globally, there are two main species of domesticated rice, Orza glabrima, the African subtype, and Orza sativa, the Asian subtype. And now that I've said sativa, I assume you're all paying attention. It's also an annual plant, meaning farmers don't just plant it once and it regrows every year, they have to plant new ones every year when the old plants die off. The ideal growing season for rice is generally between March and October in the United States, but since it's grown all across the globe, different climates have different ideal windows. The grass then takes around 105 to 150 days to grow, depending on the variety. Some varieties can even take up to 180 days to grow. Although harvested all over the world and a staple food for over half of the population, Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, and South America are the largest consuming populations. But Americans also love the food, consuming on average almost 30 pounds of rice each year. Unlike many other grains, 90% of rice is actually fed to humans. And no, not in troughs. For contrast, only 7% of soy produced worldwide is fed to humans, and only 10% of corn in the US is fed directly to humans. For more on just how widely consumed rice is, let's bring in this week's expert, Dr. Sonali McDermid, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at New York University.
Rice feeds a huge number of people. Probably wheat is another crop I can think of, but that's comparable in terms of how many people are directly eating it and sustained by it. But across the tropics, semi-arid tropics, kind of humid subtropics, and really around the world, rice is exported around the world now. Rice is critically important. Not only do we eat it as the grain itself, but we also process it into a variety of forms and consume it in various other ways.
From a farming standpoint, 90% of the world's rice is grown in Asia, mostly in China, India, Indonesia, and Bangladesh. The earliest evidence we have that rice was being cultivated was in central and eastern China around 7,000 to 5,000 BCE, which means rice is prehistoric. Prehistoric, of course, is just a fancy term for when everybody was illiterate. So it's been around for a while, and it's able to grow in a variety of places. Coastal plains, tidal deltas, and river basins in tropical, semi-tropical, and temperate regions can all be suitable places for rice cultivation. Even the Korean DMZ, where a town of about 200 people grow and sell a DMZ brand of rice and pay zero South Korean income tax because the village is run by the UN. I mean, that's dedication. Talk about getting that bread, or obtaining that grain. Karateing that basmati. Okay, I'm done. Typically, rice is grown in water, though it doesn't have to be. The reason we do, as Dr. McDermid explains, is that rice is a really water-tolerant plant.
From when you think about rice, you probably, if you close your eyes, you could probably envision this very romantic scene of paddies, maybe on the sides of a hill or sort of in the valleys of different places, right? You think of Southeast Asia, parts of East Asia. And one of the reasons that rice is grown, paddy rice is grown in these ponded or flooded conditions, is to suppress weed growth, right? Rice is a water tolerant plant, which means it can do okay in a lot of water, whereas many weeds can't. And so if you flood the paddy, it sort of eliminates your labor, it provides rice with the water it needs, and you can get away with some decent weed control.
Exactly. It's like the amphibian of plants or the Alia Atkinson of plants. If you don't get that analogy, shame on you for not following Jamaica's Olympic swimming team. She has the world record in the women's short course 100-meter breaststroke. She should be a household name. What I mean is that rice can thrive in or out of water, but weeds cannot. Weeds will drown in a flooded paddy. So growing rice in water is essentially just a very simple form of pest control. We flood the rice paddies so everything is underwater throughout the growing period, drown everything else, and we're good to go. Imagine if Minecraft were made into a real-life garden, and you've got the right image. And this offers some exciting opportunities. Of course, there needs to be good quality soil, lots of sun, and adequate irrigation to grow rice, but a lot of that can be found in peatlands. Peatlands are not lands with an alternate reality, where Pete Carroll hands the ball off to Marshawn Lynch in Super Bowl 49, he scores a touchdown, Seahawks win, Tom Brady loses his third Super Bowl in a row, the confidence hit leads him to lose the AFC Championship to the Steelers 2 years later, and the Steelers get their 7th ring against the Falcons in Super Bowl 51. I'm imagining it now. I like the peatland. Where were we? Right, peatlands. In reality, peatlands are lands composed primarily of partially decayed vegetation or organic matter saturated with a lot of water. As such, peatlands are awesome for growing rice. Often we drain peatlands to perform other types of agriculture, but with rice, we can actually protect peatlands from being drained and losing all of that rich plant fart buildup. Although if they need farts, like I said, half our team has IBS. Rice farming can even be a way to restore peatlands that were previously drained and make that restoration economically worthwhile. So that's the growing process. Once the rice has grown and there is a rice paddy beneath the grass in the floodwater, the paddies are drained and dried for harvesting. The rice kernel is enclosed by a husk and a bran, which my therapist claims is an emotionally unhealthy wall, but to be fair, the rice had a tough week. Give it some time to open up. When you buy brown rice, it's actually the rice kernel with the bran still on it. This rice is about 8% protein and has a host of nutrients, including thiamine, niacin, riboflavin, iron, and calcium, like those one-a-day vitamins, but far more inconvenient. Several a day just doesn't have the same ring to it. White rice is slightly lower in protein at 7.2% and lacks those nutrients, but it is much more shelf-stable. The process of parboiling, or boiling briefly and lightly, helps white rice retain more nutrients. Milled byproducts from rice can be used in animal feed, and this accounts for about 6% of the rice produced. In the United States specifically, approximately 20 billion tons of rice are produced annually, and 2.8 million acres of land are used to do so. Arkansas, California, Mississippi, Missouri, and Texas are the top producing states. Arkansas, whose state drink is milk, needed a reliable and profitable crop to grow in the late 1900s and stumbled across rice almost by accident. Okay, the milk thing isn't really relevant, but I had to say something. It's such a thick, uncomfortable beverage for such a swelteringly hot state. For the record, I didn't write that joke. I love milk, even though I drink a glass every day and I'm still 5'7". Anyway, over tens of thousands of years, the Mississippi River ran through many southern states and left behind a layer of fertile soil that is particularly beneficial for rice farming and farming in general. This explains why Arkansas, Mississippi, Missouri, and Texas are ideal growing environments for the crop and account for a large portion of U.S. rice production. Texas also has water from the Colorado River that can be used in rice farming. On the West Coast, California also offers an ideal growing environment for rice, with hot days and cooler nights combined with clay soil. 80% of the rice grown in the U.S. is consumed in the U.S., and the rice industry distributes 40 million pounds of the crop annually to help combat food insecurity. But despite being a great land use, massive industry, and food beloved around the world, perhaps like no other, rice farming has some challenges, and let's start with methane emissions. As regular listeners will know, methane is a greenhouse gas with over 80 times the global warming potential of carbon dioxide over a 20-year period, the efficiency of which tells me that methane would thrive in the finance world. Since rice is grown in water, flooding the fields limits the oxygen supply to the soil. And according to Dr. McDermid, that creates a problem.
When you cut off some of that oxygen supply, or when you reduce that oxygen supply, the kinds of respiration in organisms that can occur, one form of respiration is that through methane, you know, which is CH4, right? And so rice, like a wetland, it mimics a wetland because of that ponding. And sort of around the soil area, you do wind up having a little bit lower oxygen concentrations than you would if that soil was exposed to the atmosphere. And so that's what gives rise to the methane production that we see there. And if you ask the question, well, don't you get a lot of methane from wetlands too, natural wetlands? The answer is yes, you do. And that's something that's known. But for natural wetlands, those are already part of our larger carbon cycle. Whereas with rice production, right, that's something that humans have cultivated and introduced into the system, right? And so that's not to say that wetlands can't be a source, natural wetlands of methane. They are, and that could change under climate warming.
In the soil, we have many organisms called archaea. For our purposes, you can think of archaea sort of like bacteria, but any microbiologist listening will scream that they are two different things. It's like saying spaghetti and shoelaces are the same, or that Dark City and the Matrix are the same. Many of these archaea living in the soil thrive without oxygen, and when they grow, they produce methane. Due to this phenomenon, rice farming is responsible for 1.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, according to the World Resources Institute. 1.5% of all emissions from one food. I know, 1.5% sounds small, but when you consider every emission source, oil, gas, coal, cement, your parents who refuse to turn the lights off and glare at you when you do it because they think you think you're better than them, it's a pretty big deal to be a visible sliver on that pie chart. And if we look just to methane, the numbers are even higher.
So rice is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, about 10% of agricultural methane emissions, which is quite significant, or agricultural greenhouse gas emissions in the form of methane, I should say. Methane is an extremely potent greenhouse gas, right? About 20 times more powerful, depending upon what time scale you're looking at, than carbon dioxide. So it's very important that we, in order to meet some of our ambitious climate targets, that we reduce methane, and rice is one important source of that.
It's true. 10% of methane emissions are from rice farming, and the number is closer to 30% in Southeast Asia, where a lot of rice is grown. That's why, based on most rankings I see, rice is one of, if not the, highest emitting plant-based food. Not nearly as high as meat or dairy or eggs or fish, but quite a bit higher than pretty much anything else. That doesn't mean rice is bad and we need to ban it or something, but as Dr. McDermid explained, it is an issue worth trying to address. Rice farming can also lead to nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide emissions. Nitrogen fertilizers provide rice with nutrients they need in order to grow, but these fertilizers are often overused by farmers. When you dump extra nutrients on a plant that it doesn't need, it leads to poor absorption, an overflow of nitrogen, and ultimately nitrous oxide emissions, which then leads to excessive giggling and gossip between the rice stalks. Farmers also often have leftover straw, since they aren't harvesting the grass itself, and this leftover straw often gets openly burned. The burning of rice residues contributes further to emissions through the direct release of carbon dioxide. In Vietnam's Mekong Delta, for example, around 29 million tons of rice straw are produced every year, and over 80% of it is burned in those giant bonfires that the contestants of Survivor and Temptation Island gather around every night. Now, if they don't burn it, it's left to decay and emit methane in the fields, so burning it is probably preferable to that, but it's still not an ideal scenario. But rice doesn't just contribute to climate change, it's also feeling its effects. Rice has the ability to grow in up to 40 degrees Celsius heat, but heat stress specifically inhibits the growth of the flowers, which is something I relate to because heat stress also inhibits my ability to do most things besides laying in a puddle on the floor. Why does heat stress inhibit the growth of flowers, you ask? Well, according to a 2022 International Journal of Molecular Sciences paper, Heat stress inhibits the photosynthesis of functional leaves and thus reduces the pre-flowering production and accumulation of non-structural carbohydrates during the panicle initiation stage. If combined with a high nighttime temperature, additional respiration-based carbohydrate consumption will be induced, resulting in further reduction of the pre-flowering accumulation of non-structural carbohydrates in the stems. Heat stress during the panicle initiation stage results in an inadequate accumulation and supply of non-structural carbohydrates and further restricts the growth of lemata and palliae, manifesting as a reduced grain size which cannot be discerned until heading. Be right back, I'm gonna stick my head in a freezer. I'm not gonna pretend I understand what that means, but I did catch in basic terms, higher temperatures lead the plants to struggle to accumulate nutrients, which are necessary to the growth of flowers. And the plant cannot be pollinated without its flowers, meaning overall yields are reduced. And on top of that, elevated carbon dioxide levels, which if you remember can be created from the burning of the rice plant residues, can further decrease the nutrient content in rice. When exposed to high levels of carbon dioxide, protein levels in rice decrease by about 10%, zinc levels by 5%, and iron levels by 8%. In other words, rice can grow in a wide range of environmental and climate conditions, but when conditions get too extreme, the health of the plant suffers. There are also often pesticide and herbicide residues on rice, and conventional white rice can use more than 40 different types of chemicals. Happy Halloween, listeners. Time to scare you with some chemicals. Okay, not every chemical is bad, don't worry, but according to a 2011 Trends in Analytical Chemistry paper, paddy rice commonly has residue of bupropion. Or hexaconazole. Chloropyrifos. Edifenfos. These chemicals range from low human toxicity to edifenfos, which is a fungicide that can cause DNA damage in white blood cells, but the concern isn't so much looking at each chemical individually as it is the bigger picture of pest control. As climate change leads temperatures to rise, new insects may enter new areas, and since rice is grown on almost every continent, it's important to consider how pesticide use could change or increase with it. Another major challenge for rice farming has to do with water. We got this statistic wrong in an episode earlier this year, which is why I made Hallie, who wrote that episode, atone by writing this episode, but time for take two! 1 kilogram of rice typically requires around 660 gallons of water. That means that 1 kilogram could finish off over 40 kegs. It's scary to think what those little grains could do if they got their hands on some beer pong. And oddly, rice is often farmed in drought-prone regions. As climate change leads temperatures to rise, new insects may enter new areas. And since rice is grown on almost every continent, it's important to consider how pesticide use could change or increase with it. The reason that happens is rice plays an important role in food security, and it's often difficult finding other crops with high yields to feed large communities effectively. Many regions have grown rice for centuries, and it's hard to quickly change farming methods when water becomes less available. Take California, America's yoga mat, where earthquakes are just Mother Earth's way of adjusting her spine. Rice has only been grown in California since the beginning of the last century, but in 2022, the state could only plant half as much rice as they normally would because of water shortages, and Sacramento Valley, where much of California's rice is cultivated, was classified under extreme drought. Texas is also having issues accessing water from the lower Colorado River, which supports agricultural activity in Austin and further downstream. This cutoff began for farmers in July of 2022 and continued through the 2023 season as well. The Highland Lakes in central Texas are closed for agricultural access depending on the duration and intensity of drought conditions, which has also made rice farming in the region more difficult and unpredictable. How do we compensate for that drought? Well, I wish I had better advice. I've been single for over a year. But the way we compensate for it can create issues too. Some farmers are drawing groundwater, which brings its own set of issues, and some are planting less rice than they used to, which is not ideal economically or just in terms of trying to feed everybody. Imagine if Chipotle ran out of rice. It's bad enough they ran out of fajita veggies, lettuce, and carne asada. Elsewhere, rice can be hit by too much water. In the Foguera Plain in the northern part of Ethiopia, farmers rely on flooding to an extent to adequately provide the rice farms with water, but severe flooding left local farmers with destroyed fields, crops, and livelihoods. And in India, both monsoons and extreme heat are destroying rice crops, making long-term success uncertain for small businesses and local farmers who can't defend against fire and water at the same time. You'd think they'd cancel each other out, but no. 40% of rice grown in India is not even irrigated. It's just left to be taken care of by the rainfall, which can be variable based on Ghost Prince's mood. And then, of course, of the rice that is irrigated in India, 60% of that faces water scarcity issues, meaning that farmers may lack adequate access to water resources they need for a successful growing season. And it's not just availability, it's also a water timing issue. If the fields are flooded late in the growing season, as often happens, the water won't magically increase the yields. That's right, stop being late, water. It's not fashionably late anymore, it's just rude. I wanted to go to bed at 11. As my gymnastics teacher told me when I was 3, balance is key. According to a 2018 International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health study, when rice plants are put under mid-stress due to drought, yields can decrease by 17%, and that number jumps to 27.8% and then 32% when you increase stress levels to moderate and then to severe. And on the flip side, if the rice plants get too much water, yields can be reduced by 3 to 5%. As we discussed in the intro, India banned an export on non-basmati white rice just this past July. In light of many of the aforementioned issues, the country wanted to make sure it had enough food to feed its population domestically and lower prices, and has implemented severe punishments for wedding participants who waste rice on the happy couple. I mean, these are tough times, folks. Just throw sand, it's cheaper anyway. But India is currently the world's leading exporter, so countries dependent on India's exports may be unable to meet their own domestic demands in the near future because of this ban. And on top of that, Thailand, Vietnam, and Pakistan may soon follow in India's footsteps as their crops are being impacted by this year's extreme El Nino event. Check out Tip of the Iceberg 53, among other episodes, to learn more about that. But in simple terms, El Nino is a natural weather phenomenon that can bring higher temperatures, droughts, and floods, all of which would further contribute to decreased rice yields. Thailand, Vietnam, and Pakistan account for another 30% of rice sales. So if they enact export bans like India's, most of the rice sold internationally would be unavailable on the global market. Rising prices and export bans are a problem for rice, because over 3.5 billion people are directly reliant on it, and it provides up to 50% of the dietary caloric supply for millions living in poverty, particularly in Asia. The ban came at a time when rice inventory across Asia as a whole is low, meaning these negative impacts to other countries may be further amplified. Bangladesh, Nepal, Benin, Senegal, Togo, and Mali are all places heavily impacted by this ban, and they rely on India to keep up with their own demands for rice. These nations are lower income already and now have to pay higher prices for the types of rice that are still available, like basmati and parboiled. These places produce some rice domestically, but not nearly enough to feed themselves on domestic production alone. It also hosts livelihoods. There are over 150 million small-scale farms worldwide, creating jobs and bringing people income, not to mention dozens of monetized TikTok accounts dedicated to throwing rice in the air in the shape of Pikachu or a breakup text. In Iraq, for example, climate change and water shortages are causing the disappearance of amber rice. Fortunately, given the number of people with brown eyes who claim their eyes are actually amber, we could probably just call some brown rice amber and nobody would question it. In all seriousness, amber rice is a very specific variety once abundant and integral to the local culture and economy, and now the rice fields are now barren due to extreme heat waves and water shortages in the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. In 2021, to conserve water, the Iraqi Ministry of Agriculture actually limited most rice planting. Government policies and neglected infrastructure have exacerbated the situation for small farms, with large agricultural businesses receiving more aid than individual farmers. Now, only 2% of rice fields in Najaf province are being tended, mainly just to preserve the unique rice seeds. As a result, many farmers are unemployed, and locals now rely on pricier imported rice, causing a cultural and economic void in the region. The situation has led to a rise in crime rates and a black market for amber rice, which is made for some really crunchy dead drops. I mean, that stuff just pours through your hands like water. In a Washington Post article from a couple months ago, one local merchant described asking about amber rice like asking about drugs. Many multi-generational farmers have illegally continued farming the rice, in large part because that's been their entire livelihood. It's the thing they're best at. It would be like making it illegal for me to listen to 8 Pittsburgh Steelers podcasts per day, or making it illegal for me to get anxious for 3 days straight over how to phrase a text to a girl I like. Like, it's what I'm best at. It's not hurting anybody. Why on earth is this illegal? And while this is the most recent report of a rice black market we've found, I would contend that it's very likely not the only one. With rice prices rising in large part due to export bans, simple common sense suggests someone would attempt to smuggle rice from where it's cheaper to where it's more expensive. I don't know about you, but I think Kramer and Newman are the men for that job. To draw a comparison, in 2008, Forbes published an article finding rice smuggling in China, where there were local subsidies, export bans, and higher prices and panic buying around the world. They also noted similar problems in Indonesia and Pakistan at the time. Obviously, we at the Sweaty Penguin don't have the resources to expose some rice black market on the other side of the planet, though that sounds like a great next goal for our Patreon page. But again, just using common sense. That is the sort of thing that happens when you combine export bans with high international prices. Is the rice industry doomed? Will these precious grains simply slip through our fingers like the terrifying, unrelenting flow of time? Of course not. In our next segment, we'll explore how we can make rice farming more sustainable, better equip the industry for climate challenges, and ensure the people of Arkansas have a staple food to pair with that refreshing glass of viscous, lukewarm milk. Again, I love milk and don't know why the comedy writers chose to slander it in this script.
Does everything seem to always just work out for you and you want the world to know it? Then you'd really love your very own moped. You just landed your dream job, have connections in high up places, and believe your life could be a Netflix original series. Why wouldn't you have a moped? As other drivers hope you're not in their blind spot, you can romantically zip through the streets without a worry in the world. Mopeds. You're Emily in Paris, baby.
So where do we go from here? Well, in order to understand solutions to these problems, we first have to understand that there are many trade-offs. Dr. McDermid's research talks a lot about trade-offs.
I've articulated one right now between greenhouse gas emissions and yield, right, and production. You want to maximize yields, and particularly for every unit of water you use. So we call that factor productivity, right? So you want to have the most production for the least amount of water, and you want to balance that against trade-offs with methane. And also, what I haven't mentioned and talked about is you might reduce methane, but there are potential for changes in carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide, two other very, obviously important greenhouse gases. So we're interested in those biophysical trade-offs.
Exactly. We talked about one such trade-off earlier in the episode. If you use lots of water, you've reduced the need for herbicides since the water drowns the weeds, but you might not have a lot of water. If you use less water, you need a different solution for weed control. I'd say give every dad a shot of espresso and a weed whacker, but that sounds like a lot of extra work. And this idea of trade-offs expands out into other things. Dr. McDermid mentioned greenhouse gases. She also talked to us about socioeconomic trade-offs.
We're also interested in socioeconomic trade-offs, right? Which is, I think, part of what you're alluding to. You know, if low water rice production is so great and it reduces methane emissions, then why aren't all farmers doing it right now? Like, that's a very legitimate question. And the answers are complicated. Sometimes it might actually cost a farmer more to adopt something that's a rice system that's low volume. And part of that is what I said earlier, right? If you aren't flooding the paddy and you don't have that weed control, you might have to hand weed. And so now you're either paying laborers, and that's going to be coming out of a farmer's pocket, right? And so depending upon the farm system and where their sources of income come from, that could potentially be more costly. In some cases, and in some areas of the world, weeding can be a gendered, or sort of it can impact different populations like indigenous communities differently. That labor comes from different labor pools and sources. And so there are concerns that have been raised that if you start to move towards agricultural systems that are better for the environment, but that require more labor, that could have social trade-offs and equity trade-offs with sort of at-risk or vulnerable populations.
And again, this presents challenges, right? How do you address these challenges without creating extra costs or extra labor or extra burden on specific groups? It's like fixing the issue of your pillow being too hot at night by creating a portal that transports it to Antarctica and back in under an hour and charges you $500 per use. Like, sure, it cools off your pillow, but is it really the best option? That's why Dr. McDermid says, as we examine different solutions, we have to keep all these factors and trade-offs in mind.
So these are all the sorts of trade-offs, both social, economic, and biophysical, that we need to be cognizant of. And we're using rice as a case study here, but I think it's important to note that anytime we talk about changing agricultural systems and changing the way that we farm, all these sets of trade-offs and co-benefits need to be evaluated comprehensively. We can't just look at it from a yield perspective, which has really been the focus of 20th century, 21st century agriculture. We need to look at the farming system as a whole, because no matter what kind of switching we're talking about or what system, these trade-offs will arise.
So how do we do this? Quickly on the export bans, I don't want to act like I know better than India or any of the countries considering this. All that's on my resume at this stage in life is 7-1 in my fantasy league, met Jason Segel at a bar, and was called handsome by an old lady at Starbucks one time. But here's the thing with export bans. Not only does it hurt other countries, but it can skew markets in your country too. To use India as an example, if the ban means there is less rice traveling out of India, it would presumably mean more rice in India, which means rice prices would be cheaper. great for consumers, but that could mean less money for farmers, which means some farmers may not want to farm rice anymore, and the ones that do, in addition to struggling in general, also would be less likely to invest in some of these solutions we'll discuss in this segment. Not to mention, India has essentially turned down money from other countries who are buying their rice, shrinking their overall economy. Honestly, can you imagine turning down money? Like, how are they gonna buy Super Mario Bros. Wonder now? Again, I'm not going to act like I know better, but this is just how economics tends to work when you impose a trade restriction. If the goal is to have more rice or more affordable rice or address food insecurity, there are ways to do that that don't harm the economy, harm farmers, and harm other countries that you trade with. To me, it seems more prudent to address the root causes of the problem rather than pursuing restrictions. And with that, let's consider what addressing those root causes can look like. Starting with water use, there are several strategies farmers can adopt. For one, farmers can consider avoiding planting rice too early in the season. Cooler conditions mean the plants need more water for a longer time without a significant increase in yield. By getting that timing right, you can get more bang for your buck. It's like asking someone to be your girlfriend on February 15th. You get all the benefits of the relationship, but don't have to drop $400 on flowers and chocolates. Wait, crap, her birthday's in March? Damn it, I had that all planned out. Planting too early can also lead to water loss as it can seep away from the plant roots. Another option some researchers recommend is turning off irrigation a bit earlier in the growth cycle. Again, this ensures rice plants make the most of the available water without unnecessary wastage. And there's a number of other strategies too. But what's exciting is by ensuring the rice crops use all the water that gets put in, it may help with not just water use, but also methane emissions.
Well, one way is to not create the conditions where you've got these methane-producing bacteria. And that would basically mean to try to eliminate some of that water, that flooding, that ponding that occurs, right? That creates those, that kind of low oxygen condition. And so that's one way that we're exploring through this low volume, you know, water rice production that we can improve upon that system.
Another option is to grow rice indoors. This eliminates the crop's need for ideal growing conditions because they can be manipulated inside a greenhouse. Growing crops inside allows farmers to monitor temperature, humidity, water levels, and awkward small talk with neighbors. Seriously, Gary, I don't want to meet your new iguana. Indoor farming often results in not just higher yields, but predictable yields. However, there aren't greenhouses everywhere, especially in low-income countries that farm rice, and contrary to what most farm simulator games would tell you, they don't magically appear just days after you pay some sketchy old dude to make one. It takes the purchasing of land, the investment in a building project, and operating costs that are often high since farmers are heating or cooling a large building and paying for computer monitoring and controlling. This is sometimes energy intensive and often includes many upfront costs that many farmers cannot afford. You could try to have governments incentivize indoor growing through grants or subsidies, but that brings downsides too, costing money and disrupting a free market. So again, there's trade-offs. Indoor growing may improve yields and have environmental advantages, but it also may not be realistic for many communities that grow rice. Another option is a growing practice called the System of Rice Intensification, or SRI. SRI is a farming method introduced in Madagascar, the country, not the movie, although I'm sure King Julian would declare himself the Lord of the Rice if he got wind of it. And SRI aims to boost rice yields with reduced resource use and environmental impact. The core of SRI lies in four main principles. One, planting younger seedlings, which offer greater growth potential. Two, spacing these seedlings out more widely, ensuring each plant gets adequate nutrients, water, and sunlight. Three, using organic fertilizers to enhance soil health and reduce the need for chemical alternatives. And four, decreasing water use, since rice doesn't require constant flooding, and this can result in substantial water savings. These adaptable principles, when combined, lead to significantly improved rice production and environmental benefits. Today, 10 million farmers in 60 countries have already adopted SRI and have found it to be quite successful. SRI has led to a 20 to 100% increase in yields, uses up to 90% less seeds, and can reduce water usage by 50%. Please ask your doctor before using SRI. Side effects include nausea, drowsiness, and bothering your friends with statistics every time you stand in line at Chipotle. But that's pretty cool. Water use and the number of seeds were seen as a trade-off to yield traditionally, but this method is proving that the industry can find some balance. SRI involves using fewer and younger plants that are carefully spaced, and farmers keep topsoil well aerated by weeding and recycling manure from animal farms. And by using younger plants, Dr. McDermott explains yields are more easily controllable without fancy technologies.
I think what has been encouraging about it is that you do see, particularly when it's coupled with other management strategies like transplanting your rice seedlings early or directly seeding your rice. Usually rice is grown in a nursery and then it's transplanted a month or two after it's been in the nursery into the paddy field. And so when low volume rice production is coupled with some of these other management principles, they tend to have a pretty good yield benefit. Again, I'm just talking about yields. I'm not talking about full cost to the farmer, but the fact that it is possible to do this and not sacrifice yields, I think that's a good step in a really strong direction for adaptation.
Farmers using SRI have the ability to invest water into the plants they know will succeed when there are fewer plants. They avoid flooding these farms to conserve water, and it's a much more accessible method than growing rice in a cartoonishly large glass cube. In Bihar, one of India's poorest states, more than 335,000 hectares of rice are grown using SRI. Many farmers report satisfaction with the method and hope to continue to improve their practices without having to sacrifice their multi-generational rice farms and livelihoods. Farmers could also shift some of their farming to other grains. Why don't we have more Honey Nut Cheerio farms, right? Not saying we need to get rid of rice farming, but switching some farmland over to another crop may be an option too, because by diversifying, farmers reduce their risk of crop failure, since other grains may be able to tolerate conditions rice can't.
It is possible that in some areas, it might make sense to switch from rice to another crop that might be a little more drought tolerant or heat tolerant. Particularly in areas that are now fueled by a lot of groundwater that's running low, right? And may become sort of economically unviable or even just physically unviable in the future. And those areas, stand to be exacerbated by these extremes, right? Droughts and flood.
In Vietnam, for example, some farmers are already switching what they farm to adapt to rising sea levels. Farms near the coast now alternate between farming shrimp and farming rice on the same land. Just start farming some peppers, broccoli, and soy sauce there, and you've got yourself a stir fry. Now, this does come with its share of drawbacks, too. First off, the shrimp are really not pulling their weight on the farm. Like you'd think, as an animal, they'd be helping apply fertilizer or fixing tractors or something. But no, they just swim around and do nothing all day. It's like no shrimps want to work around here. But beyond that, cultivating a shrimp colony means there's lots of organic matter, chemicals, and antibiotics polluting coastal estuaries and groundwater sources, which can leave farms ill-equipped to grow rice when it's that time again. Shrimp also isn't a substitute for rice. Just ask my ex who bought me a pound of prawns for my famous party-sized horchata recipe. But it doesn't have to be shrimp. In India, researchers found that replacing rice with corn, finger millet, pearl millet, or sorghum could reduce water demand by 33%. These are grains that could be rice substitutes, though we don't entirely know how global markets would react to a shift in the grains we produce. Obviously, if we swap out the crops we grow, but no one buys the alternatives, that's a bit of an unfortunate situation. That's why I had to shut down my cinnamon maple mayonnaise farm. In general, though, having farms focus on a wide range of foods instead of just growing one thing could absolutely improve food security and the overall business. That transition does take time and education, though, so there are certainly some roadblocks to that approach, too. There are also different varieties of rice that may be more resistant to climate change. Growers can select for rice plants with fewer stomata so that they can take less water and evapotranspire less. These kinds of rice plants need around 60% less water, are less impacted by salt water that could intrude due to sea level rise, and they only demand to see a therapist once a month. Talk about a rice that knows how to seek out help but also has developed skills and a support system to handle issues on its own. Go off, king! The low stomata variety has been tested in academic laboratories and is very much in the early stages of development, but given its ability to tolerate drought and salt water, it may become a more stable option for some growers. This variety isn't as efficient in extreme temperatures, though, so if drought is combined with high temperatures, there may need to be more research into a turducken variety that can handle heat, too. We can even repurpose the rice debris that contributes to carbon emissions, and not just to use it for those cursed 5-minute craft videos. Nothing like some rice debris in your disturbing, useless creations. Instead of burning them or using them for some horrendous DIY project, husks can actually be fed to livestock. This may actually decrease demand for livestock feed from other industries like soy and alfalfa. More of these crops can be fed directly to humans, and the husks aren't going to waste. For this to be feasible, there needs to be a distribution system in each country that grows rice that allows farmers easy access to a recycling system for leftover plant material. You know, like Nespresso. That isn't easy, but it is certainly something that could be built out and may even be profitable if farmers want to buy that delicious husk feed for their livestock. Nespresso execs, DM me if you want to partner on this. As Dr. McDermott tells us, many countries that grow rice also have lofty climate goals, so a practice like this would be a big step in the right direction.
A lot of countries that are key rice exporting countries, like countries in Southeast Asia, like Vietnam, look at Bangladesh, India, right? Many of these countries have actually determined that in order to meet their nationally determined contributions, so their commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions per the Paris Climate Agreement, many of these countries have named rice and improved water management and rice very specifically as one way of meeting their NDC, their climate target goals. And so this is important because if a state government, if a federal government, a nation says that they want to improve water management in rice in order to meet their climate change agreement, right, their commitment, then they need to figure out ways that that strategy can be deployed across the nation, right? How do you scale? How do you get all the farmers who can to adopt this way of farming when, as you know, right, historically, culturally, rice has been grown in the way it's been grown for a very long time, right? In some cases, thousands of years. So how do you get farmers to adopt a different set of management principles?
Look, I get that none of these solutions work across the board. Every farmer and every region will have its own share of challenges and responses. But it's certainly encouraging that farmers have so many options and countries can choose what works best for them. If we can reduce emissions, conserve water, and address economic insecurities, we'll have more rice, a smaller carbon footprint, and ensure we can have our shrimp horchata and drink it too. How this episode normalized shrimp horchata but dissed milk is beyond me. Mm-hmm. This wraps up episode 129 of The Sweaty Penguin. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. You get merch, bonus content, and more. Clips today came from NBC News. Special thanks to our Emperor Penguin patrons, Lawrence Harris and Brownie Central. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you next week.